Hi, I'm Nikki from Tyrion's Landing, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Camille Kajuri, and you're listening to Gunna Fairy Public Radio. And so you should. Keep your finger on the button and don't stop listening, because there's nothing better anywhere else.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
Did you just say womp womp?
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 189 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've discovered evidence of our twin podcast, believed only as legend, that has returned to the airwaves with a sinister plot to rob us of all of our microphones, high-speed bandwidth, and tasty snacks. But we've got one trick up our sleeves with these heartless mutants. Fire up the Z-bomb!
You bastards!
I am Jay Witten, and with me in the GPR studios tonight is Keir Hansen. How are you doing tonight, Keir?
I'm angry, I'm furious, I got stakes in this game.
And also, Haley, how are you doing tonight, Haley?
I'm pretty good.
She's not nearly as furious as I am.
Apparently not.
Grr.
Well, this week we reach a milestone in our wilderness year rewatches of classic Doctor Who serials with The Tenth Planet. Not only is it the introduction of the Cybermen to the series, but it is William Hartnell's last sequential adventure on the program before handing the TARDIS controls over to Patrick Troughton in the final seconds.
Yeah, this and thankfully, one of the reasons we brought this up last week, why it was the one that we're going to be able to cover, is because while this is technically one of the stories that contains a lost episode,
it's too important to skip.
That too. But thankfully, with the existing audio, with a lot of still shots from the set, with a few snippets that were actually still available from the original aired footage, including the final regeneration moment. There was a Planet 55 back in 2013 did an animated reconstruction that is really kind of entertaining. And we'll definitely discuss it. But I guess we consider that complete then, because we have a DVD release. It has all four episodes. Call that a complete story. So let's take a look at this. There's a lot going on in the story. This is one of Kit Pedler's great science fiction base premises. You know, I'm going to sing Pedler's praises repeatedly through First and Second Doctor for coming up with science fiction stories that just had, you know, good plausibility. You know, even if they were outlandish by 60s sci-fi standards, they were just good stories. What do we think of this one?
Yeah, this was it was an interesting story, and it's one that we have seen retold a couple times throughout the years. And you know, as I'm watching it again, I'm just sitting there thinking, man, this is kind of tropey. This is like, I've seen this over and over again. And I was like, but all of those came after the fact. This was I don't want to say the original, but this was early on. And this was the one that very likely inspired a lot of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, people give this one so much credence, obviously, because of its origin stories, not only for the Cybermen in their Mondus variation, which lasts for quite a while, and yeah. I still miss it. I mean, not that I don't have any problem with the reset on the Cybermen that we got in the new series, but I still dig this idea of the planet that's gone awry and the need for survival slowly turning to cybernetics getting to be the vast majority of the human construct.
Yeah,
and then
except for the face, which is a sock.
Well, you got to wonder what's going on under there. You know, you're like, what kind of beastly, you know, Deadpool looking mess is still underneath there? You know?
Actually, it's not even quite a sock. It almost looks like the Rebel flesh.
It's a ski,
like,
it's a ski mask that they forgot to actually cut the holes. They just marked where the holes were going to be and didn't, they lost their scissors. So, but I mean, down, and the voices, my God, I love the Mondo Cyberman voices. I love it because for the first couple of minutes, you're like, oh, I can't listen to this. It's all there all over the place. And they stress all the weird syllables. But after two episodes, you're like, just give him a phone book. I'll listen to this all day long.
I mean, we were talking about this over the week when, as we were watching this, like comments were coming and stuff. And Kier makes some comment about how he enjoys it. And I'm like, well, at least next convention we show up to, we know what to ask Nick Briggs to do.
Oh, yeah. He's done it. I actually think when I saw him back in March, or was it March or April, at Regeneration, and he had brought the ring modulator there so that during his panels, anytime he wanted to, he'd pick up his alternate mic and he could Dalek all the time. But I think during one of the panels, someone was asking him about the Cybermen because he had to do that for some of the Big Finish stories, and he had to do original series, you know, the Mondo Cybermen. Mm-hmm. And that one just required a little bit of tweaking, but it was all done through vocal inflection. So he started snapping in and out of that as well. And I think he actually said something about the infectious nature of it. You kind of get stuck in the mindset of doing that odd speak. But I'm just thinking, imagine going to, if they still talked like that now, and they didn't have that heavily, you know, modulated, tweaked voice that they have now, which is still cool. I mean, I love it. So it's one of the reasons why I love, I'm doing another Lego Dimensions reference here. When I'm playing as the Cyberman, I love it because he gets into it, that voice, and you put the Cyberman in the TARDIS in the game, and it says the Cybermen have finally acquired the time vehicle known as the TARDIS. And you're like, yeah, I love the Cybermen. I love them and all their permutations. But in this original version, this origin story, especially because of the fact that they still have human hands, mm-hmm. You know, and they're just basically wearing silver pajamas with a lot of contraptions. You know, they're going at people with pulses of light that can cook you from across the room. So they're basically they've got a microwave outside the box that they're just pointing at. I mean, it's all plausible kind of stuff. And especially if you just sit there and you just run through the script, which corrects some of the fact that, you know, in some of the edits, there's some pacing things. It's always going to be the case. It's the nature of it. But it's a really compelling story.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of exposition, but it doesn't really feel like exposition too much. Maybe because their voices are so outlandish. But they do an awful lot of explaining why they're doing what they're doing.
I mean, to be fair, they really don't do that much more than Hartnell typically does. We're just used to it from him.
That's true. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I also really enjoyed out of this was the fact that, I mean, so you're in this Antarctic base. So you're an isolated location again, mm-hmm. Which is always a great kind of setting. But every once in a while, you'd get this contact back over to International Space Command, which we should really have. I mean, this was supposed to be set in 1986. It's 2016 now. We should have a space command, International Space Command by now.
Yeah, but none of this whole, like, you know, NASA versus everybody else. Just, no. It's space.
The ISS was the best we could do.
I mean, what's NASA doing even?
Even that's clunky. But what is NASA doing these days? SpaceX, come on. But I love the fact that they'd have to go through this bureaucracy, which sounds accurate, you know, but you've got this military, you've got the general who just wants to, especially as he's realizing everything that's going wrong. And then he's got his son involved in it this whole new element, you know, and now all regulation, all military protocol, all everything goes right out the window.
Right.
And he's just, kill everybody. I don't care. He's just, my son is up there. Just don't mind the 6 billion people down on Earth. Who knows how many lives out on Mondas. It doesn't matter. Blow them all to hell because we've got to bring his son home. I don't know. I love it. There's these over-the-top emotional elements. There's the plausible scientific aspects of it. I guess if you want to take a twin planet that was presumed to be lost 10 million years ago or what have you, that's somehow coming back on its own accord. How?
Don't question.
But, I mean, I don't know. And the idea of what's our first response? We're going to nuke the hell out of it.
Well, that sounds accurate.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, we're starting to come into the, you know, this is the thick of the Cold War at this point. And I don't know. There's all kinds of aspects to the story that I absolutely adore. And then you take it to the farthest point where you see Hartnell. And this is one of the things I wanted to ask you guys about. So we saw a lot through this last season as we've been doing these rewatches, that Hartnell was taking breaks during filming. Like they would write the Doctor into an incapacitated state so that he would get a kind of a break on screen for a little while. But this almost seemed very fitting because, I mean, they were writing it into it. He felt like he was being stretched thin. Ugh. And you start hearing these lines and the way they've been reused now. You know, makes you think, like butter across too much bread.
That's exactly what I thought.
But how much of that do you think was actually called for in the story, or how much of it may have been written so that it would give Hartnell those kinds of opportunities? Did you get that kind of a feel as you were watching?
Yeah, in this one, I definitely think that it was purely to give Hartnell a break. Like there didn't seem to be any reason aside from, you know what, we've had him on his feet for two episodes. Let the old guy sit down.
Give him a chair.
Mm. I mean, it didn't seem to serve the purpose of the story at all.
Right. But he did through it all, even though you could see that the fatigue that was written into the character for the story and that he was conveying, you know, obviously on screen was one that didn't interrupt his desire to continue to assist and advise and so forth throughout. We'd had other stories that we had watched where, well, even with the War Machines, there were times when he was either knocked off his feet momentarily or what have you and couldn't really contribute. And it was up to the companions in those instances or supporting characters to kind of come up with some of the solution sets for the issue at hand. Even here, though, when he was barely standing or barely upright, he still knew adamantly what had to be done. He kept sticking to his guns on it, kept trying to advise the general, even when the general was ready to put a gun to his head.
Yeah.
Just sort of an interesting dichotomy for him to end on, so to speak. Still sticking to it, still trying to be the assistance, even when his body physically was failing around him.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it was kind of sad when he first comes on screen because, you know, we've kind of been bouncing around and everything like that, but there's a gap from where, you know, Ben and Polly come onto the TARDIS when we saw him last to this one. It's like, you can tell his health is deteriorating. Like he doesn't look as well as he did previously.
No.
And it was upsetting, but I mean, because we know the story, we know how it progresses and we know everything that was going on. It's upsetting to see that because you know exactly how bad it is. And you know that he didn't want to leave the show. And this was something that he was going into this, knowing this was his last story, that he didn't want to, but he couldn't argue with them either.
Mm-hmm. I have to wonder, and I guess this is one of the conversations that has come up through a number of interviews, is the idea of incorporating the regeneration and how much tipping of their hand was done prior to this, you know, as far as public awareness, or really highly, publicized announcements that this change was going to occur. Because it's difficult for us to fathom present day and age about any sort of casting change that isn't, at least we know that a change is going to happen.
Yeah.
We don't know, at what point in the season is it going to occur? Are they going to replace the character? Or are they going to actually write someone else into the script? Are they going to do this, that, the other? Have they already cast somebody new and so on and so on and so on? And we get bogged down in the minutiae. At this point, you think about where this was taking place in October of 66, there may have been some people that knew, whoa, okay, well, they said that William Hartnell is going to be leaving the show. Does that mean the show is going to end? So they're tuning in to see if this is going to be the finale.
Right.
I would imagine that a good percentage of the viewing public had no clue what was going on.
And yeah, and that's the thing that we've discussed before is like that we've lost the ability to have a surprise regeneration on the show. It's like you know well ahead of time that the actor is going to leave. You know well ahead of time who's going to be the next person cast. Like that you can't keep that kind of thing secret like you used to be able to, but you know, as you said, that this could have been something that was known ahead of time. It's, I would have, I would have liked to have been able to see what the general consensus of the viewing public was when this was going on.
Hmm. I'm sure with a little bit of
research. We know what a regeneration is. Audiences at the time didn't know what was going to happen. So even knew a new actor was coming in, they probably were like, oh, well, this role is now going to be played by a different actor and we're going to just keep going.
Right, right. And there was absolutely nothing in the script that actually implied that there was going to be a change. It was very ominous. I mean, it looked like he was just deteriorating and that something was going horribly wrong. We didn't know if that just meant, okay, well, that means this doctor is gone and now we're going to meet somebody new who's going to be an entirely different character that carries on the show or
a new alien from the same planet.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because we had very limited information about, you know, what was actually going on back in this home planet. We didn't even have a name for it yet, either for his species or for the planet itself. We don't get that until much later.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been absolutely fascinating. But I guess one of the things that I wanted to kind of bounce off here was this idea of all these different solutions that were being offered. You know, I go back to what Pedler put into this story and the idea of, I don't know whether it was a kind of a statement that the predominant military figure wanted to go at it through, you know, extreme force, whereas the representative of this global consortium, you know, this international space agency, wanted to go through things very diplomatically until such time as he turns around and it's a Cyberman right in his office. How did you get in? How did you get past security? Is this Star Labs? I don't know. Sorry,
Gunther's
I had to throw
on the door.
But like, there were just these perfect little kind of stereotypical representatives of these government entities, and then from the scientific community, you had our one poor professor who really, I mean, he was with the doctor the whole time. He understood it completely. He understood exactly where the doctor was going with this. Wanted to help him sabotage the rocket. Sure. Oh yeah, I know. I'm probably going to get shot for this. In fact, I'm about to get shot for this, but I'm going to help you anyway. I just think the story itself, I just keep going back to the fact that structurally, and even at the break points in the episodes, you know, these good, acceptable cliffhangers at each point in the four episode breaks made sense. I just think this was a really well structured story overall.
Yeah, it really was. And that's the thing too, is that it was a compelling story. It was something that, you know, it kept you going until the end. And the fact that it's a regeneration episode, it almost seems secondary. You know, this was a good introduction to a villain that we still have around today. This was it was just a fun science fiction story, you know, in the not too distant future kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were just so many things about this episode to like.
I think if the only thing that I would probably want to change was that at this point, I mean, Ben had his premise, you know, he gets locked away and he starts, you know, relying on his wits to say, all right, I'm going to use my penknife, I'm going to break into the vents, I'm going to do this whole Mission Impossible thing and so forth. Or the idea of blinding the Cybermen with a film projector. I mean, these are all kind of cool little aspects. That's okay. Ben's kind of cracking a little MacGyverism here. He's resourceful. Polly, though, I just expected at this point, now that we've spent more time with her and we've seen what she's capable of, that they would have given her more. Then she did a lot of worrying, a lot of coffee fetching. Really?
Yeah,
this is where we were going with this.
That bothered me. It's like, well, let me help. What can you do to help? I can make coffee. Really? Really? Like, I know it was 1966, but come on.
Yeah. And that was the thing. When we first met her, she was an assistant to a scientific advisor. So you put her in that kind of position again. But like, no, the character has grown by now. We now have far more of an opportunity to see that she is as resourceful and as reliable as Ben in the instances given the opportunity. So that was a bit of a step back.
Yeah.
But thankfully, we weren't entirely done with it. We were able to kind of carry through and we get that going into our first Troughton story. But again, lost episodes. You'd have to rely on it by script or audio if you wanted to follow it. Oh, and that's one more thing. Now, I know you guys watched the animation. Have either of you had the opportunity to watch the loose cannon reconstructions?
That, I think that's what I saw was the loose cannon reconstruction. I didn't see the animation.
Okay. So you got to see there were actually some bits of footage.
Snippets of, yeah.
Right. Those few. Yeah,
it almost looked like somebody filmed a TV.
Yes. That's exactly what it was. Okay. They would point a camera at, they would point a camera at the same monitor that they were using to watch the dailies. Or what we now know effectively as the dailies. So that they would have that kind of capture. So anytime you saw that, the quality just went absolutely berserk. Oh, but that was because you were getting a shot.
It's terrible.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's the only thing that I'm not entirely certain on was why we have just those odd little moments. I don't know if they were editing points where that was some of the film that remained. Or
somebody took those home and they were found in a shoebox years later.
That kind of a scenario. But it's just very odd that we have, you know, like them pounding on the TARDIS when they're locked outside.
Yeah, there's like three or four spots in the episode where they have, I don't know, 15, 30 seconds of footage.
Right. But it's also just really interesting that they have that final glow moment of the regeneration when they try to do the face overlay.
Mm-hmm.
But Haley, we'll make sure that we get the
animation.
The animation from the DVD set from 2013, because it's actually, I mean, it kind of, you know, it's... whatever you look at
it, probably gives you a better sense of what's going on in the story.
But it's interesting. I wonder, and this is something I'll have to see if there are some people that I can tap into we know the scripts exist and there are some descriptions within there as far as stage directions that are from the original scripts. And incidentally, you know, and I had found this just a little earlier that there were alternate scripts, obviously, that had been written in case, Hartnell was not planning on exiting, you know, if they were going to be using the episodes in a different sequence within this season, so that there a regeneration doesn't actually occur at the end. But Pedler had these alternates. But within those scripts, they had some rough stage directions, but it wasn't necessarily going to be a shot-for-shot kind of breakdown. So there was some, I would assume, some creative license from the animators in deciding how they were going to honor the way that... that the three existing episodes had been shot, and knowing what Derek Martinez had laid out as far as the way that he was framing things. But it's kind of cool. You could definitely tell that they were relying on any of the remaining footage that was done or any of the set photos that existed so that we knew, okay,
yeah,
when they got to this point within the fourth episode in the script that it was a wide shot. All three of them were in the frame and so forth and so forth. So they tried to honor that as best they could. But I'm sure that there were a couple of cases, especially when you get down to the really dramatic moments about dealing with the, you know, like the dissolving Cybermen and such.
Yeah.
About how you were going to present that.
It was very interesting because there's parts of it where you can see that they are remaining very true. You know, and like the way that the Cyberman falls over, you know, it's like you can tell that this was almost done exactly like they were watching the person. You know, it was clunky. It was very badly like, you know, it was the shoddy stunt work that you expect to see from some of the stuff. But
well, right, because you didn't know, especially with some of those scenes, anything with the action, because of it, all the intricacy that was done into the props. You fall over with all that stuff. You break your helmet, and if you have to shoot it again, now you got a broken helmet. We've only got three of these, so.
But then you get scenes like when Mondas is breaking up and they're able to cut loose and they're able to fill in what they weren't able to do in 1966. And it still remains true to the art style that they had, but it looks so much better than anything we could have gotten at the time.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. And they went back I'm pretty sure that it was Planet 55 that did, I think, as many as eight of these now. So they filled in things for the invasion, which I think we've covered before, and a number of other stories. So I don't know whether they plan to continue to do it, because it's usually one of those instances where they rely on them for what they consider to be a really marketable serial
right. That
is missing maybe one episode. So it's not going to be a really long turnaround process, but they haven't done much in a while. So to see, I mean, there was just the, what was some of the most recent ones? I'll have to go back and look. I mean, I've acquired them all at this point from the DVD sets, but
mm-hmm. I don't remember.
I don't know. I still enjoy it, though. I think there's a benefit to both, really. The reconstruction.
Do you know how profitable it was?
Well, insofar as I know, at least for this particular set, that it made it through numerous re-releases, because they would run off a certain number of tens of thousands of them in terms of original.
And sell them all.
Yeah, sell them through, and they would do them in very calculated numbers, because they're not going to, they don't want to sit on a closet of 5,000 DVD sets and so forth. I mean, they're down to the point where they watch it that carefully. I got to wonder, though, at this point, granted, a lot of these decisions were being made, even you take it as most recent as 2013. I don't know if they were really considering so much about digital distribution. That may kind of change the model going forward. So,
yeah.
If there's a, you know, in terms of assessing the ROI on the marketability of doing these kind of efforts or paying this company to do these kinds of recreations, if they think that, all right, now we don't have to worry about the overhead of actual physical product distribution, and we can just say now at the BBC shop for direct download, you know, as easy as turning it over to iTunes and Google Play and so forth, and just saying, okay, they're there for you.
That could change quite a bit, yeah.
It has to. Because if that's really one of the things that was shackling them before, was the concern about the physical product persisting and collecting dust on shelves, and that's out the window, I would hope that would grease the wheels a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
because we've got a lot of episodes to fill in.
Yeah. That's definitely something to consider.
So I guess one of the last things I wanted to check with you on was kind of the idea of the Doctor's final moments itself, you know, and how it was kind of how you reacted when you got a chance to really see how rapidly in those final 5 minutes that it's getting to the point where he's barely able to speak. He can't hold himself upright any longer. He's not responding to anyone. And the way that they handled, especially Haley, because you got a chance to watch the footage itself, they hold that scene, that final shot for the regeneration, which is just, you know, from forehead to chin for a long time. I want to say it's at least 45 seconds of screen time. Is pretty powerful. I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, the part that they actually have footage of, I don't think it started before he was, like, I think it the footage they had started after he had fallen.
So, well, you see it, the knobs twitching and such, and you see the time rotor going.
Yeah.
And that's all kind of considered part of that. And you got the dematerialization sound effects, and that's where he's really at the point where he's on his descent to the floor.
Right. And I actually wondered if some of that might have been footage from another episode that they put in to fill this one out. Like some of the shots of the TARDIS operating.
I don't know, because in the animation, that's what they honored as well.
Okay.
Like shot for shot.
Yeah.
So if that wasn't the intent, then they actually drew from loose canon, which sounds unusual. But I'd have to see whether or not it was actually in the original calling script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I almost felt like there should have been more. And on one hand, I felt like it should have been drawn out a bit because it was such a momentous thing. I mean, this was his exit from the show, and you're spending, you know, 60% of the time with the camera focused on the console. But then at the same time, it just seemed to drag on for so long because nothing's being said. You know, the last we saw of Ben and Polly was that they're pounding on the door, and then magically they're just inside next to him. You know, and there's just not a lot going on except for random, you know, smash cuts to different things. And then all of a sudden he's on the floor and they're inside, and it's, you know, either shorten it up or add some more to it to let us know what's going on.
Yeah. I have to see. I think I see both sides. I think I agree. Maybe the first one or two times I watched it, I thought, God, I gotta wonder if there's some dialogue missing here. If there wasn't at least some pleas for help from Polly and Ben or something, you know, or trying to rustle him and wake him or something of that sort. But then I thought, well, okay, well, maybe they're just leaving a lot of this to subtext. And it did actually occur within my mind. I started trying to piece some of this together. I'm like, well, okay, well, the TARDIS let them in. Mm-hmm. The controls are operating themselves. Yeah. Timer is going on its own. He hadn't flipped these controls. So the TARDIS is preparing for something. It knows him. And we haven't even gotten to the point really about talking about TARDIS sentience or anything that really hadn't been addressed much in the show for quite some time.
Yeah.
So this is all things where you can look at it in hindsight and piece all it together and say, oh, okay, I've created this story in my head. And I don't really mind some of that obscurity because it allows me to do that. Especially things like, you know, like them entering and he's already on the floor and everything's operating on its own. But that long hold on his face when they do the overlay, mm-hmm. you know, and they brighten everything to a near whiteout and come back and just barely get a hint of Troughton. Like it's almost like it reminded me quite a bit of when they did the Night of the Doctor episode, and that transition starts and you get to
you see little hints of Eccleston in it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, it wasn't Night of the Doctor. I'm Day of the Doctor. Sorry. I hope they get the ears right. You just a little hint there. But yeah, I don't know. It still kind of hits me in the feels because it's one of those things where, and you said, Jay, you know, you kind of wish that they would be good based on the momentousness of the occasion, but they were flying by the seat of their pants on this. They didn't know whether or not this whole thing was going to work.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, you know, like you said, you know, it's going back and you fill in the story yourself to make it fit what you know now. And that's kind of what I'm saying too, is it's like, this was the first regeneration. I mean, this is a huge thing, but at the time it was like, we're risking everything that we've built over the past 3 years on this gamble that nobody's ever done before. You know, so yeah, I can understand why they didn't want to make it a big deal at the time because they weren't sure how it was going to play. Yeah. But going back and looking at it now, it's just like, oh, I wish they'd had more faith in it because it needs to be something more.
That's fair. Yeah. I mean, hindsight being what it is.
Yeah.
I guess. But I think to a certain degree, and we've noticed this with a lot of the rewatch episodes that we do, and we talk about things like, oh, the pacing, or why did they, you know, why didn't they just edit this so that it's just the dialogue's a little tighter or what have you? But in a lot of these cases, I think it's just a matter of the viewing audience at the time was accustomed to doing that sort of mental fill-in.
Yeah.
In a lot of these cases, not only just in the nature of the way the scenes are being shot, but also the story itself. And you think, well, they didn't really do a lot of explanation. There's a whole lot of hand-waving going on here. Well, this is the first time that any of these tropes, or what we now recognize as tropes, had ever been handed over to the viewing audience. So to them, they're trying to process all this.
Yeah.
So it changes their viewing experience.
That's very true.
So I draw them a pass.
Okay.
You're far kinder than I am.
I guess so. But overall, I gotta say that, I mean, to take absolutely nothing away from the pivotal nature of the regeneration and everything, one of the things that I consistently, when I go back to rewatch any of these and I just find myself enjoying it the most, if it's not the Cybermen talking, it has to be General Cutler.
Oh, God.
I mean, he is so bombastic.
And every time I saw him on screen, I'm like, this is the great value version of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, but his delivery is entirely Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
You damn dirty apes, you blew it all up. But I loved it. He was just, it was so, so entertaining in a nearly cartoonish sense.
Yeah.
Pun intended with the animated final episode. But I loved it. I loved it. I just wish that there were, you know, I would have loved to see the emotional breakdown moment where he's talking to his son and he realizes that his son's got, as he perceives it to be, seconds to live.
Right.
And has one of those things where, listen to me, son, I never told you all those times. Playing ball in the front yard. You know, but he never got to have one of those.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like you said with the Cybermen. It's that when he first comes on and you're just like, oh, really? Somebody get this guy a fork because the scenery's not going to last long. But the longer he's on screen, the more you get into it. The more you're like, yeah, let's do it. Come on.
Crank it up to be angry
crank
about.
Crank it up to 11.
Have the handle break off his coffee mug. Something. Just get him more pissed off.
And that, I mean, that's... that's one of the things about this episode is it's, there are so many things that you could easily just kind of look at and be like, yeah, no, you know what? I can't get past this. This is beyond obnoxious. I'm moving on. I'm going to skip this one, but it's, you don't, you stick it through because it's entertaining. It's an entertaining story and it keeps you to the point where the stuff that irritates you at first becomes your favorite elements.
Absolutely. And I think there's like this weird little internal wink with everybody who was in the snowcap base that they know that their general is like this, because every time the general would like get on the PA and this is an important announcement, and you'd see Professor Barclay's face, like he'd look over, like almost breaking the fourth wall, and just, oh, God, we go again with it. The guy was living for those moments. And all these poor little schlubs all running around the base going, oh, God, where's he going? Do I have to put on the snowsuit? Do I have to go back outside again? He keeps making me go back outside. Every time he gets on the announcement, like, I'll go put on my boots. I'm probably going to get killed by some robot out there. Happens every time.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this was a great story, and it's – I love going back to watch this one. I never remember how much I enjoy it, but it is so much fun.
It is. Yeah. And I don't really want to categorize it as necessarily, but it is a great swan song for Hartnell, because it's one of those ones where he gets to kind of put some of his best elements forward as far as his problem solving skills, his unfathomable knowledge. You know, when he hands a slip of paper over, he already knew what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's that great idea of the, oh, well, did you see that I wrote down who the killer was before, you know, in a sealed envelope that was already in the room kind of thing. Just love it. Absolutely love it. So this is a must watch. I don't care if you're skipping around and you're piecemealing Hartnell just to say, well, I don't know, the sets are kind of weird and the soundtrack's kind of strange and the acting is, ooh. Please, do I have to watch any more cavemen fight? Well, this is a must.
Yeah. I mean, there are few episodes of Hartnell's era that I say that you have to watch. Like, I mean, if people are saying that they just want to skip the First Doctor entirely, I'm like, no, no, no. There are a couple episodes that you absolutely have to watch. You know, and obviously, you know, an Unearthly Child usually falls in there because it's the first.
Yeah,
the Dalek story, even though it's a bit hard to get through, it's important for setting up. But
it is long. But yeah, but it sets a lot of things in motion that are necessary. It establishes a lot of canon that is necessary.
Yeah. But
Aztecs too, to a certain degree, because that's as far as companions' importance, that's a pivotal one in there too. And I'm glad it's one of the ones that obviously survived, but it's also one of the ones that for a while Netflix was carrying as part of their available set and so forth.
Back
so,
when they carried Doctor Who.
Let's, hold on. I gotta pick at the scab for a second. Hold on.
Yeah. No, but
it's almost healed
this,
over. Thanks,
this Jay. One here is, this is almost one of those that I don't, this is one of the first ones that I throw out there because it is so important.
Yeah. And it actually segues really well into Troughton's era, because by the time you get to like Tomb of the Cybermen, obviously, you know, with some of the changes that occur in the stories between, but you're well prepped for a lot of the things that 10th Planet sets in motion, you know, and it establishes. I think this is one of the things that, while the Daleks became iconic from their first appearance because no one had seen anything like it, even though they didn't want, I don't want no bug-eyed monsters on my science fiction show. But the Cybermen were bizarre. I mean, the whole idea of cybernetic half-zombie sentient robots that were actually us. I mean, the whole premise of it is just insane.
Yeah.
But it's so well established within this first serial that it's no wonder that when they decided, well, all right, what monsters are we going to continue to use? Well, those Cybermen were creepy as hell. Let's keep using them.
Yeah, and that's one of the things is it was interesting because I've heard somebody referred, like, talk about the difference between the Cybermen and the Daleks, how it's like every time you see the Cybermen, they're a little bit better. They're a little bit more upgraded. Like, every time you see them, there's more different about them, whereas the Daleks haven't changed at all. Like, they're almost exactly the same as they were back in the day. And
no, they're Skittles now.
Right. But But the thing is, it's like you look at the two different villains and you've got opposite ends of the spectrum. You've got the Cybermen who are constantly trying to upgrade themselves, who are constantly trying to be better, who are constantly, you know, trying to reach the next level of upgrades. And then you have the Daleks on the other side who are, you know, they already think they're perfect. So why would they change at all?
Right. And they're just spending all their time trying to weed out any signs of imperfection.
Yeah. So it's a fun way of showing that these, you know, it makes sense why these are the two big bads, because it's, you know, either end of the scale there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know. I mean, this is, I think as far as, I don't know if you could get away with sort of bookending the Hartnell era by boiling it down to maybe four stories. I have a four in mind. I mean, I think there is something of value out of just about everyone that you could tap into. Mm. And I'm glad that we've had the opportunity to dance through a lot of the ones that we have, even the gunfighters, damn it.
Yeah.
So, but that's, this one in particular is one. And especially, I do love the fact that this does give us a carryover companions, granted for a very short period.
Yeah.
But I think that's pivotal if you do get the opportunity to go through the scripts and see, or if you have means to gather the reconstructions to see where things go as far as Troughton's first establishment as the Doctor and how companions are dealing with the change of persona. This sets precedent for everything. And we're not done. We're really not done. I mean, we're about to see this with some of the stuff we'll be getting into in the news tonight about what they're going to be doing with filming with Pearl Mackie as Bill. We're still wondering, you know, how does the every person deal with seeing the outlandish happen in front of their eyes, and how is each companion that gets exposed to this greater reality going to react based on their personal background? And since we don't know anything about one companion from one story to the next, the possibilities are limitless. This is gold, absolute gold.
Yeah. Well, we ready to jump into the news then?
No question.
Well, as you mentioned about Pearl Mackie, she's actually done a little bit of appearance on social networks lately.
I love this. I think this is great. I think she is going to be the connected voice of the cast that the internets have been waiting for a while. Jenna was getting us close. Matt Smith was barely trying to figure out how Twitter was working.
Jenna had her Instagram, which she would, you know, she'd post on every now and again, and it was great.
But Pearl is dialed in. And she shares everything that she's been given clearance to share. So now that we are officially about a week into principal filming for Series 10, and the set photos have been coming at us pretty consistently. In fact, if you're willing to deal with some potential, I don't know how to phrase this carefully. I'm just going to say internet jerks who have decided to take over a hashtag. So you can follow DWSR as a hashtag to see what's going on set. And oftentimes it's people that are just at various locations around Cardiff saying, oh, no, I saw they put up signs to close off this road for today. Or, oh, it looks like they changed the signage in front of the university to call it a different location today. It looks like they're going to be doing such and such and so forth. Or if you're fortunate enough, set photos that are being taken, obviously, from a reputable distance with massive telephoto lenses that are more than I make in 3 weeks. So, but there are some folks who decide that they're going to, you know, jump in. If you're just trying to follow the hashtag and see what's going on, there's a lot of people that are saying, oh, I just saw, you know, Peter Capaldi punch a puppy or something, because they just want to, you know,
be jerks.
But aside from that, some great stuff that we've been seeing from Pearl on set, stuff that she shared, and actually a little video walkthrough that she has done, taking us around one of the set locations, which is kind of cool because she feels comfortable enough to be able to talk like, I'm just one of the crew now. So she's well in place.
Man, that flower arrangement she got really went a long way to boosting her confidence, I guess.
I think so. Just today, I know there was a lot of stuff going around. I'm not really sure where they are in the production block as far as what they're supposed to be shooting for at the moment, but they also had Nardal, Matt Lucas's character, on set as well, still wearing that weird jacket and his little Cartman South Park hat and everything. So I don't really know. I mean, obviously, when we last saw him, his head was in a giant robotic body somewhere down in the bowels of a giant robotic body. So he's got his full form. For what that's worth, I don't know how they're going to work this in. But apparently Bill gets exposed to him.
Well, phrasing.
But the coolest thing. So go look over the set photos, and I know how many of them you guys have gotten a chance to see over the course of the day today. But Capaldi, or just over the course of the day's shoot, just this past 24 hours, went through like 3 costume changes, and he's got all these cool new arrangements for 3/4 length coats and hoodies and
yes,
you seen some of these? It looks awesome.
One of the coats he had, instead of having the red lining on the interior, is blue.
Yeah, like a really intense blue. That's awesome.
Like that's that's my cosplay. Yeah.
With the white button down shirt, buttoned all the way up, no tie. So still working the thin white Duke look. So yeah. There was actually one thing I noticed. I don't know how recent the article was, where they were talking about some of the set decisions that they had made for Capaldi's Doctor and his starry, holy sweater. You can't really tell what's going on with it. And there were so few of them made that they sent the set crew out to buy every single one they could find because they didn't know. They couldn't recreate them. They tried to make a few in the wardrobe shop, and they're like, this isn't working. All right, just release the hounds. Let's go buy dozens. I don't care. But it looks now where he's just going with some of these variations of the hoodies and stuff, and his hair is freakishly long right now. It's just a big old silver poof.
Full-on bouffant.
Full-on love it. They have to let him grow a beard this season.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
Because he had it.
He looks so good with the beard.
Look awesome with it. I mean, not even just like the little Van Dyke that he had when he was doing the Musketeers.
Like a crazy beard, man beard?
Yeah, just nuts. Just have wide-eyed hair. Pfft. Oh, be great. Just have it at some point during the series, he goes through a rough patch and he's on a bender.
Okay.
Well, you know what?
He found Time Lord bender. Well, River did show him where the liquor cabinet is.
But yeah. I don't know, because during the whole break period, he grew the beard out and he was making appearances with it, and like showing up at hospitals and stuff with kids with his beard. Like, what's wrong with the doctor? He looks insane. Hair,
more
eyebrows,
insane than usual.
Beard, everything. Just top of the head, front of the head, bottom of the head, everything. Just poof, poof, poof.
Too much hair.
The
on
doctor's
top.
Being taken over by a carnivorous tribble.
I love it.
Oh, geez.
But in terms of Mr. Capaldi's awesomeosity and his appearances recently, Jay, you came across this one, the video footage from, was this from Dallas or where was this from?
I don't remember which con it was from. I mean, there have been a whole heck of a lot.
He's been on a real bend. Well, obviously, a lot of the Who crew, right before filming started, they went on some wild ride going around doing a lot of appearances. And yeah, no, it was from Dallas Comic Con. It took a moment or two for during the Q&A session for a little 6-year-old to ask their question. Prompt a little bit. Mom tried to help out a little bit. But when he was finally able to speak into the microphone, to the audience's delight, it was a matter of saying, you know, when I want to grow up, I want to be a part of Doctor Who, you know, kind of just as you did.
Yeah.
So what should I do to help that make that happen?
Well, and it was great the way that it plays out, because this kid, you know, he gets up and says, I really like Doctor Who. When I get older, I want to be part of the show. How do I do that? And you can see the look on Capaldi's face, just like he gets this big old grin, and he's this close to being just like, aw. But, and then he looks at the kid and he goes, well, you've come to the right person.
I've been where you are. Let me tell you what I did.
It's so great because he goes on to, and it's not so much a step-by-step guide to, you know, how to, it is more of an inspirational speech to everyone in the room about whatever the heck it is that they want to do with their life.
It really is. It's things like, you know, just be kind to people, you know, do your homework, you know, be nice to your parents and so forth. You know, it's just, it's all these life lessons. But then he fits in this great little moment. He's like, and if you write a letter to the BBC and tell them, I really love Doctor Who, and they'll put that in a cabinet somewhere years later, they'll dig it up and say, oh, this kid, that's just great. And the fact that that just, and all that just rolls off the cuff. Just again, if you needed, if you absolutely needed any more reassurance that this is the perfect individual to be representing this 5-decade legacy at this point in time for viewers young and old, this is the person to do it.
Yeah. It's like I said, when I found it and I shared it with everybody I could find, I'm like, you know, every time I learn something about this man, I fall more in love with him. He is just absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm.
And if you trace it down to actually follow it back to the Reddit point where the original video got shared by the mom, she indicates that he is actually writing that letter right now.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
You know, that's going to get framed somewhere over somebody's desk at the BBC.
I want to see this in Doctor Who magazine in like the next few months.
Oh, yeah.
It needs to get put in there.
Oh, yes. So last little point just to tack into the news here is just that obviously we'll make sure that we share some of the filming photos that have been going around. There's been a few so many of them were released just within the last 24 hours that it's now a matter of you can either follow the hashtag, but there's a few articles that are being posted that will allow you to be able to kind of call them together based on which resource that you use. Granted, I'm sorry, a good number of them are the Daily Mail. I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry. At least it's not the Mirror. So, hey, there you go.
It could be worse.
It could always get worse. But we'll be expecting quite a bit of that in the weeks ahead. We will continue to follow with that as new stuff comes around. Especially things like, I'm trying to figure out right now, based on some of the costuming decisions that they've done for Bill's character, whether or not we're really understanding her original time period, because some of the stuff they've got, like her trainers that she's wearing and stuff, are by no means 80s. So
her costuming seems very almost anachronistic. I don't know if it's either we're not sure where she really comes from in time, or she's just got a very retro feel to a lot of her outfits.
Exactly. Which I think that could be some of the fun that they're playing with us, is that she's got a kind of a retro look about her, but that's just her personal choice and she's contemporary. So,
that's what I've thought from the start.
There you go. So that's where Haley's 25 cents is.
You could have helped us out with the betting pool.
I'm willing to say that she is actually from the 80s, and as she travels to contemporary periods, she goes shopping.
Because what else do you do?
She goes to the 80s and goes shopping.
Oh, God. Oh crap. That's a third quarter on the table now.
I mean, that's what I do. Give me a time machine. I'm going to go back to the 80s, and I'm going to buy everything that I couldn't do at the time. Because that was the height of fashion right there.
Sure it was. But speaking of a little bit of
he's talking about the shoulder pads. They were very high.
They were massive. That would be the telltale sign. You know, how large are Bill's shoulders during any given shoot? You know, how many layers of foam batting are under there? That'll tell us how genuine her commitment is to the 80s look.
Mm-hmm.
But what are we going to be touching upon for next week? Because we're coming into, here in the stateside, we're coming into a holiday weekend where it's all about America.
Right. Well, since we've kind of lost our national pride in the UK for the moment, we're going to focus on, yeah, on the good old US of A. Somewhere I was going with that. I swear to God I did.
I'm hearing King George singing a song in Hamilton to me right now about what comes next. Anyway. Yeah. So we are going to be looking at all of the, well, all, yeah, well, we'll try to at least touch upon them all. All of the instances where the Doctor has had his various exploits here stateside. So from Angels Take Manhattan or a number of appearances where he's been in Washington and things of that sort. So we'll have we'll call it our Coming to America episode of the Doctor over here.
Complete
promise we'll hand him back when we're done. What's that?
I was saying complete with our Eddie Murphy impersonations.
I love it here. I'm in Queens.
All right. Well, this has been episode 189 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you will enjoy this episode.
And this is Kier saying, you didn't let me blow it all up. You damn dirty Cyberman. You blew it all up.
And this is Haley saying, I don't want to go.
We'll see you guys next week.
Adelzy.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
So, Haley, you don't look nearly as sunburned as I thought you would be after your first day of work out walking cell phone towers in 110-degree heat.
No, no, no. I'm in the office right now. I haven't started on towers and stuff yet.
This is not what I bargained for. I want more entertainment and sun poisoning.
Okay, I'll work on that.
A mandatory heat stroke minimum.
We ordered the extra crispy, Haley. Yeah,
this is original recipe. This sucks.
Hey, knock it off.
Yeah, Shade, you jerk.
No, it's the other one.
Oh, the other one. Who doesn't get a name because...
No, the,
she
the
has
other,
one.
Other one.
We just don't use it.
The other one.
Felicity.
Seriously?
I didn't name her. She was named Felix, and then I was like, hey, that's a girl cat. You know that, right? Oh, her name's Felicity.
You know, you're allowed to rename cats. They don't care. They'll respond to anything.
No, they don't. They respond to the opening of a food can.
As often as I use her name, what do I care? She's butthead most of the time.
I could see Haley walking around the house. The other one! Where are you, the other one?
Oh, man.